From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Senator John McCain and Senator Barack Obama are working to make sure people who do support them get to the polls, and they're trying to attract swing voters who haven't declared their support. So what are the campaigns doing in the final hours of Election 08? We'll check in with the Obama campaign in a moment, but first we've got Ben Porritt, a national spokesman for the McCain campaign. Hi, Ben.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Okay, so let's start out with redistributionist. Just today, Senator McCain called Senator Obama a redistributionist, but Senator McCain's proposals on health care and finance, among others, would redistribute at least some tax dollars. So is that inconsistent with his campaign rhetoric?
Well, not at all. I think the point that Senator McCain is making is that the philosophy that Barack Obama shares on taxes is to provide tax relief to those who aren't paying taxes. It is he wants to crush our small businesses with higher taxes on capital gains, higher taxes on income. So the philosophies that both these men share are completely different. And as we head into Election Day tomorrow, that's been the case we've been making for several weeks. So Barack Obama said it himself. He wants to spread the wealth around, and we want to make sure that going into tomorrow, all voters know that.
What states do you think are going to be critical for you tomorrow?
Well, you know, we've outlined probably about 15 core battleground states that we've been paying attention to. And I think that, you know, we feel very, very good about our get-out-the-vote efforts. We feel very, very good about the support on the ground in all of these states. And I think that we're going to be really paying attention to Colorado. We're going to be paying attention to Ohio, Pennsylvania, Virginia. And we're very hopeful that at the end of the night we're able to not only flip a blue state like Pennsylvania, but we're able to really keep into our category some traditional Republican states like Virginia, Colorado, and you know, some of the other, in a state like Missouri, for instance.
During this campaign, there's been talk about Joe Sixpack and the real America. Of course, the swing states that you're mentioning, some of them are really places where you are seeing people who were haves sliding into the category of have-nots. How effectively do you think that your campaign is wooing people who feel as if they've lost ground in the past 8 years? And if so, on what basis are you wooing them?
Well, you know, what I can speak to is our Get Out the Vote effort, which is world class. I mean, we've put a ton of money into that. And I think that in key battleground states, we have doubled and in some cases tripled the personal contact that we've had to get these people out to the polls. More importantly, on a message, it's important that we tell these folks who have had a rough time over the last 8 years with the economy and have seen this government expand when they thought that we would cut spending as a party, and we haven't. But the message that John McCain is saying is, look, I'm not going to raise anybody's taxes. I have the plans and policies to get this economy back on track. I am a tested and proven leader. And on the other side, Barack Obama isn't. John McCain has spent more time in a Vietnamese prison camp than Barack Obama has spent in the U.S. Senate. Barack Obama has never been tested as a leader. And going into Election Day, we have serious, serious issues on the table. And Barack Obama, on the economy especially, Barack Obama is the only presidential candidate in modern history to advocate for a tax increase at a time of economic crisis. So there are vast differences in philosophies. And for those who are hurting out there who want to see this economy get back on track, we got to keep taxes low, reduce spending, and make sure that small businesses can continue to create wealth. And that's what John McCain's plans do.
I think that the issue of taxes is one that's better explored with some background fact-checking on what happened during the Bush years in terms of redistribution of tax wealth. And on our website, the overall NPR website, npr.org, if you go to politics, you'll find a lot of fact-checking on that. I will just say that and move on, but I do want to talk on the experience level about Governor Sarah Palin. It has become the question of her experience has become one of the biggest issues and a big dividing point for movement conservatives as to whether or not they really buy into her as a leader for the party. Regardless of whether or not Senator McCain wins tomorrow, and I know that this is really what you're looking at, do you think Governor Palin has a future in the Republican Party?
Well, you know, John McCain said the other day, and I obviously tend to agree with him, that, you know, regardless of whether he had selected her as vice president or not, she was going to burst onto the national scene at some point. She's a rising star in our party, and, you know, I would beg to differ with you on the points of experience. You look at the resume and the record that Sarah Palin has built, not only as mayor of towns in Alaska, but also as governor, I'd put her record up against Barack Obama's any day. Barack Obama. Yep.
I just want to make sure I get to this last point. Very
sure.
Quickly, if Senator McCain wins, what do you think will push him over the top? If he does not win, what do you think will have been the issue?
Well, I know that everybody who's made predictions this election have certainly struggled. But I think, you know, if McCain wins in the climate that Republicans are facing right now, this is just truly a testament of John McCain and his brand, the fact that we're being outspent 3 or 4 to 1 in these states, and, you know, we are the underdog. If we win, it's all because of John McCain's brand and the way the American people see him. If we lose, maybe I can come on and explain that later, but we're extremely confident and optimistic that we will be celebrating tomorrow.
Okay, Ben, thank you so much.
All right, thanks for having me on.
That was Ben Porritt, a national spokesperson for the McCain campaign. And now we turn to Corey Elans, director of African American Media for the Obama campaign. Hi, Corey.
Hi, good to be with you.
So some 90% of black voters are expected to cast their ballot for Obama on Election Day. And some people are even predicting that Senator Obama might exceed Lyndon Johnson's record of receiving 94% of the black vote. That was back in 1964. So if elected, what will the senator feel he owes to the black community? And how will he seek to transform specifically the lives of black Americans?
Well, I think that's an interesting question, because if you look at the level of support that Democrats have received traditionally over the past several election cycles, it's usually teetered around the 85 to 90% level. So when people say that Senator Obama is receiving this exorbitant amount of support from the African American community, I think that's slightly off base. I think you have to look at our history and see how African Americans have supported the party in the past. What I would say as far as what the agenda will be for African Americans, it actually is an agenda for all Americans. You've heard about his proposal to cut taxes for individuals who make less than $200,000 a year, not to raise taxes for those who make under $250,000 a year. And you've heard about his proposals to bring teachers to our schools to provide education, to provide health care to a wider group of individuals around the country. So when you talk about the agenda for African Americans specifically, you're actually talking about the agenda for America that Senator Obama hopes to implore.
There was a moment when we got to speak with Senator Obama about affirmative action, and he made remarks in the past that said that his daughters, who were privileged, should not necessarily have the same access to affirmative action as someone who was black but who had socioeconomic difficulties. Is that something we can expect to play out in an Obama presidency, if there is an Obama presidency, that specific issue, but also that philosophy of moving towards economic-based justice as opposed to racial-based justice?
Well, I think mainly what the senator was attempting to say is that ultimately we need to offer individuals all over the country the opportunity to achieve based on their abilities. And ultimately, what we're trying to do is expand opportunities for all people, not just for a narrow group. And what he's saying is that we should consider economic issues concerning that as well, in addition to traditional individuals who've been held back in the past.
Now, the senator has been aggressively linking Senator McCain with President Bush and his, quote, 8 years of failed policies. But Senator Obama has avoided criticizing the Republican Party as a whole with the same vigor. What does that bode for in terms of bipartisan approaches to governing? Is this an attempt during the campaign to lay a foundation for bipartisan governance?
Well, I think Senator Obama has talked about this in ways that would seek to bring people together. This is not an indictment against the Republican Party per se, but this is an indictment against the 8 years that we've had with George Bush. The one thing I can tell you as far as African Americans are concerned is if you look at the quality of life for this community over the past 8 years, it's been on a steady decline. First of all, we've lost some 500,000 jobs among African Americans since George Bush and Dick Cheney came into office. There are nearly 2 million African Americans who are unemployed right now. There are 7 million African Americans who are without health care. So it's not so much an indictment against the Republican Party as much as it is an indictment against these 8 years of George Bush. And if you, as the senator said, if you want to see what a McCain administration would look like, just take a look at what we've had for the past 8 years, and that's embodied in what we've seen from President Bush.
There are signs that lower-income Americans from communities of color, younger Americans from communities of color are going to show up and vote at high numbers. What is Senator Obama's vision for the future of industry in this country and steering young workers into jobs? Right now, there are a lot of industries that don't have any jobs.
Well, one of the things that he said is that we have to take a look at how we create jobs in this country for sure. And one of the main things he's talked about is developing green jobs, developing jobs based on this new economy that's going to come about because of our new look at the environment, in addition to our energy policy as well. That's actually been one of the main staples of his urban policy, is to take a look at how we can change and redevelop our urban communities by developing jobs, making them more greener, and making them more accessible to more people in the community.
Is that going to happen fast enough so that people do not begin to blame Senator Obama if their lives are not what they'd hoped?
Well, look, we said that this is going to take some time. We didn't anticipate this economic travesty that we've seen over the past several months, but I think that we should appreciate that with Senator Obama in the White House, we'll have someone with the confidence, with the and with a steady hand and a real plan to deal with this economy on a real basis. It's going to take some time. It's not going to happen overnight, but I think the policies and ideals that he has outlined during his candidacy will put us on the right track to righting our economy.
All right, Corey, thank you.
Thank you a lot. Good to be with you.
That was Corey Elins, Director of African American Media for Obama for America. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. John McCain and Barack Obama are dashing across the country to make their final pleas in critical battleground states. Joining us now to talk about the last day of this historic election, we've got Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania and the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, and Robert Trainum, D.C. bureau chief for the Comcast cable network CN8. Hi, guys.
Hi, Farai.
So it's an exciting time, and let's just jump right on into it. Senator John McCain's campaign manager, Rick Davis, has declared that the senator is having one of the greatest comebacks since the candidate won the primary. Let's listen to what Senator McCain said this weekend.
There's one day left. There's one day left until we take America in a new direction, my friends. And we need your help. We need your help. And we will win. Volunteer, knock on doors, get your neighbors to the polls. I need your vote. We need to bring real change to Washington, and we have to fight for it.
Robert, do you think the race is tightening, first of all? And if so, why?
Yes, the race is tightening. If you take a look at all of the 408 national polls out there, every single poll shows that Senator Obama Senator McCain is closing the gap. The reason why is twofold, Farai. Number one, the race always tightens towards the end of the election. But secondly, look, John McCain has always performed his best when his back is against the wall. Recall, we were on this program about a year ago, and everyone was writing his political obituary when it came to him being the last in the polls in the primary, him being the last from a fundraising standpoint. Now, granted, I would be readily foolish if I did not admit that he has an uphill battle to climb. However, he has closed in the polls.
All right. The McCain campaign has tied Barack Obama to the idea of socialism. And here is Senator McCain from a rally today.
You know, Senator Obama's running to be redistributionist in chief. I'm running to be commander in chief.
Now, last week, Senator McCain went on CNN and host Larry King asked, you don't believe Barack Obama is a socialist, do you? And Senator McCain answered, quote, no, I do believe he's been in the far left of American politics. He has stated time after time that he believes in, quote, spreading the wealth around. Mary, what is the crux of this argument? Is it the concept of socialism or is it the question of what happens to your tax dollars?
Well, first of all, let me just remind everyone who listens that I didn't write off McCain. I was the last one who said when he was dropping dead in the primaries and everybody wrote him off that I would bet my house that he'd have a comeback, and he did. I'm not going to bet he's having one this time. but in any case, and I'm not betting my house. In any case, what it really is about is a statement that Obama made to Joe the plumber.
Mary?
Yes.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second because we're having a little bit of a technical problem, fuzziness on your line. So we're going to come back to you. We're going to take a look at that. In the meantime, Robert, while we wait for Mary to come back on the line, what do you think of this whole question of socialism, the word socialism? Why is it such a third rail?
Well, it is a third rail for a number of reasons. We as Americans have always fought against socialism, at least from an intellectual standpoint. We saw that in Eastern Europe. We saw that, obviously, in the former Soviet Union. We as Americans do not believe in socialism. We believe that every single person should be able to write their own path, if you will. And so when you have someone, presumably Senator Obama in Senator McCain's words, using the word socialist, it means I know better than you. You don't know exactly what you're doing, and so the government, or thus in the process, the government leaders have to decide your fate as opposed to you as an individual. And, you know, intuitively, we're against that. That's not who we are as Americans.
At the same time, though, when Senator McCain, and I watched this on television, seemed to be somewhat reluctantly say, no, he's not a socialist, the rhetoric of socialism had suffused the current degree of the campaign. Is there a way in which the senator is trying to benefit from the negative connotations of the term without taking full responsibility for it being in the campaign?
Absolutely. Look, he's trying to write those dots, and hopefully he wants you to connect those dots. Look, he's saying one thing, and he is insinuating another. He's saying that Senator Obama is not a socialist. However, on the campaign trail, he's actually saying he is a socialist in terms of some of his ideas. When it comes to the whole redistribution of the wealth, when it comes to the whole Joe the Plumber analogy, Americans like examples, and a lot of Americans out there can identify and can relate to Joe the Plumber. And if you take a listen to John McCain, Farai, over the last couple of days or couple of weeks, John McCain actually found his voice with Joe the Plumber, just in terms of trying to put a real-life example in people's minds so they can understand, oh, you know, if this person makes $100,000 a year or $150,000 a year under Senator Obama's plan, I'm considered rich. And so thus in the process, Senator Obama, underneath his plan, wants me to take some of that hard-earned money that I've earned and redistribute it to other people.
All right. Well, let me do one last thing. And the question, you know, before we go back to Mary's back. I was about to go to another question before.
Let me just catch up quickly with what Robert said. Yes, I don't think most people really know what socialism is in any detail. It's one of those words like when you call people liberals or something. They assume that it's un-American, whatever it is, socialism, not understanding where it exists and whatever. And Obama has never said he was a socialist. He has talked about a progressive taxation and the need for people to pay taxes who can afford to so that we can have the kind of public services that we need. But it's a good campaign gambit for McCain to try in the last days, since he has to try everything he can, including the kitchen sink.
I want to go to dig into a little bit more of the state races. And so both candidates are campaigning hard in Ohio. It's been one of the most important states in the campaign. It was extremely important last time around. Some polls say the state is too close to call. Let's listen to Barack Obama campaigning in Ohio.
In 2 days, Ohio, at this defining moment in history, you can give this country the change we need. And it starts right here in Ohio, right here in Cincinnati. This is where we need to make it happen.
Mary, just quickly, what's the historical significance of Ohio?
And Ohio is where the Republicans always need Ohio to win elections, and they usually win Ohio and win elections. And Kerry last time thought he had won Ohio because the exit polls told him he had won, and then he found out that according to the vote count, he hadn't. And there were long lines of people standing in line and all kinds of problems. Ohio was almost Florida last time, Florida 2000. so that it's crucial for McCain to take Ohio. Typically, Democrats do well in Cleveland and in Cincinnati, and this time Columbus is going to be very important because that's where the university is, and Democrats do well in university centers and not so well out in the rural areas. But Ohio has all of these major economic problems, even worse than some other places in the country. Now the Democrats control the election machinery there because the governor is a Democrat, unlike last time, and the Secretary of State is a Democrat, so that Obama has a good shot to take Ohio. And if he takes Ohio, I think that that'll be the end of McCain.
All right. I want to make sure that everyone knows the folks with whom we are speaking. We were just hearing from Mary Frances Berry, professor of history at the University of Pennsylvania. She is also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. We also have with us Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8, and this is NPR's News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea, and we are doing some pre-election politicking. Robert, what other states do you see having this same focus? I mean, is there anything besides the economy, perhaps, is a way to put it? Are any of the swing states, places that are on the fence, is the economy driving, you know, not driving any of them?
No. The economy is the number one issue in every single state, but even most importantly in the battleground states. A strong second is Iraq. A strong third is healthcare slash education. But look, everyone is affected by the economy for obvious reasons, and so everyone feels a little bit uncertain, not even a little bit, but a lot uncertain about the direction of our economic future. And so what they're looking at is they're looking at both presidential candidates and their economic policies and saying, as it relates to me, who is going to be the best person that's going to keep food on my table, keep gas prices low, and then thus in the process helps me keep my job.
And McCain was floundering on the economy because he had said it wasn't his strong suit. And then when this crisis occurred, then in fact he really looked, he was floundering. He didn't know what to do. And Obama just really made hay out of this issue. Recently, in recent days, McCain seems to have gotten some of his footing back, especially since the Joe the Plumber business. So we'll have to see whether there's enough time between then and the election, the actual election, to give him enough support there. But the economy has displaced Iraq. It has displaced terrorism. Nobody even talks about terrorism as an issue. There's no discussion of Afghanistan and the like, and that has certainly been a boon to Obama.
Although, for I know we're running out of time, very quickly, if you notice over the last couple of days, the McCain campaign has tried to shift the focus from the economy back to keeping us, quote unquote, safe in the war on terror. And if you take a look at the overall polls with undecideds, there's about 7% of undecideds out there. Historically, undecideds typically vote Republican, historically. And the reason why they vote Republican is because, quote unquote, the war on terror or national defense. We'll see if, in fact, they put John McCain over the top or perhaps Barack Obama.
This campaign can't end without a few more surprises. But the latest one we've gotten is came out on Friday that Senator Obama's aunt from Kenya is in the country illegally, having overstayed a request for asylum that she was denied. It seems to have faded a bit even since Friday. Is this going to be an issue, you think,
Farai, the McCain camp said it was not an issue. That was smart. They were smart to say that they weren't going to make an issue of it. I think for Obama, he said his campaign said he knew nothing about the various things with this woman. The problem is, to be fair about it, it won't affect the outcome, is that he talked about this aunt before in his writings. And it's not as if he didn't know her, or at least he said he knew her. And so it seems a little curious that he knew nothing about what had happened to her after talking about her being his favorite aunt. If it's your favorite aunt, you somehow know what's happening to them. But it came too late, and the McCain campaign is not making anything out of it, so I don't think it'll affect the outcome.
There was a kind of poignant footnote to this, which was that she's made donations, which are illegal,
yes,
as small as $5. It kind of says a lot about probably what her life is like, but also at the same time the complete flouting of the law in this case. Robert, what's your read on whether or not this is an issue?
Well, I agree with Mary. It's a lukewarm issue, and the reason why is because, again, the audience right now is undecided. And the last thing that you want to do going into, 24 hours left into this campaign is to give any of those undecideds the EBGBs or anything to give them pause. And for some undecideds, it's actually very well may be an issue for them. One, this is your aunt on your father's side, and presumably knowing that she's from Africa, you had no idea that she was in this country. Two, she's living in a public housing facility in Boston, Massachusetts, and you would never think that maybe, quote-unquote, to check in on her. Senator Obama is a very intelligent individual. And so to suggest, as his campaign has said, that they knew nothing about this, again, to use Mary's words, is quite curious. Lastly, again, the McCain campaign is very, very smart not to make hay out of this, but it also gives you a little bit of an insight as to the McCain campaign and who John McCain is as a person. This is the second time when a personal issue has come up, the first one being Jeremiah Wright, the second one now being Senator Obama's aunt, that Senator McCain has said, no, I'm not going to use that in this campaign.
Except the Pennsylvania Republicans are using the Jeremiah Wright thing, even though McCain said it should not be used. In the closing hours of the campaign, they've been using it.
But it's not directly Senator McCain's campaign, right? That's doing mm-hmm. that.
No, it's a Pennsylvania state ad. Nonetheless, there may not be as much of a distinction in people's minds who are voters. They may not look at the end of the ad and say whether or not, you know, there's a Senator McCain's face or Senator Obama's face saying, you know, I endorse this. All right, guys, we have made plans to catch up with you after the big day on Wednesday. But going into the big day, what do you think that we need to look for? One thing, whether it is long lines, potential voter disenfranchisement, resurgence of McCain. If you had to point out one thing, Robert, that you think is going to be the big story on Election Day, what are we talking about?
I think the big story is going to be how close this election actually will come down to. I do not think this is going to be a blowout. There are a lot of folks out there that are suggesting that it actually will be. Again, John McCain has always been a closer, and given the fact that there's a lot of undecideds out there that have yet to make up their minds, and we have no idea with how the race, meaning lowercase r, meaning ethnicity, is going to play in this race. I think we're going to wake up Wednesday morning and say, wow, what a roller coaster ride.
Well, I think that we should be looking to see what the turnout is, not so much in the urban areas where we expect large turnouts or areas where there are large numbers of African Americans, but see what the turnout is in western Pennsylvania, in the rural areas in Ohio, the turnout in Missouri, in the areas outside Kansas City and St. Louis. If there are huge numbers of people turning out, showing their support, that means that McCain will get a bounce. If they just seem like a normal group of numbers of people coming out, then you know that his voters aren't as energized as they might be to try to help him pull it out. But if I were to predict, I'd say Obama probably will have a landslide.
Robert, do you agree with that?
I do not. Well, I agree with Mary's first point in terms of turnout in the rural areas. These folks, if they do come out, they're not coming out for John McCain. They're coming out for Sarah Palin. And the reason why they're coming out for Sarah Palin is because she has really energized this base. And thus, in the process, a lot of conservatives, ideologues, believe that she's the future of the party.
Mary, when you take a look at the Republican Party, there have been some questions over divisions within the party ideologically. But the Democratic Party, there are a lot of people coming together around Senator Obama who may not actually have that much in common. So what's left of the Democratic base of support?
Well, the Democrats, solid, whatever their views are in terms of trying to get this, you know, get some more seats in the House and Senate and get Obama elected. The fracturing in the Democratic Party is going to come right after the election. And then you will have people who are conservative, blue dog Democrats in the Congress. You will have people who supported Obama to win but who think that he is not progressive enough, and others who think that he is too conservative. But all of these different factions will fracture. But for now, everybody has just sort of decided to come together until they can get the election behind them.
Fry?
Yes.
Very quickly, I agree 150% with
wow,
Mary.
Wow, 150?
And let me go one step further.
It does have to be quick.
No matter who the president is come January, 6 months from now, their base will be upset with them. I guarantee you.
Always happens.
Yeah, it's very true. All right, Robert and Mary, thanks so much.
All right.
Thank you. Make sure you vote.
Yep.
Thank you, Farai.
And we're going to be catching up with Robert and Mary the day after the election, speaking with Robert Trainum, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Comcast Cable Network, CN8, and also Mary Frances Berry, Professor of History at the University of Pennsylvania. She's also the former chair of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. And if you tune in to us virtually tomorrow at nprnewsandviews.org, our blog, you will see video blogs from us throughout the election evening. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. Tomorrow marks the end of the longest presidential campaign to date. This election looks like it might break all voter turnout records, and plenty of civil and voting rights groups are out there working to make sure you have a place to turn if you're having trouble voting. One of them is the NAACP. In September, Benjamin Jealous became the youngest man to lead the country's oldest and largest civil rights organization. He's got plenty of information about how to protect your vote. Ben, how are you?
I'm doing well.
So you are the head of this storied organization that has had so much to do with African Americans and voting. You think about where we've been in the past decade with the contested 2000 election. What should people know, first off, about going to the polls and doing it in a way that protects their vote?
Sure. You know, there's really two things that I say to folks. And the first is that you should be prepared. You know, you should really think about the time you need and make sure, you know, if you need to have somebody watch the kids, that you just take care of it. This is one of the most important things that you'll do in the next year, and just be prepared. The other is to have the number 866-OUR-VOTE, 866-OUR-VOTE with you. Because if you have any problem, if you feel like you weren't treated fairly, if they're not, you know, if the line is hours and hours long, and they're not offering you a provisional ballot. If you know that you signed up to vote and they're saying that you're not on the list, if you dial 1-866-OUR-VOTE, there are lawyers who will come to your aid right away. And we working with the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights, have made a tremendous effort to make sure that the hundreds of thousands of voters who have problems will have somebody who can help them.
What is it like being the head of the NAACP and watching this election unfold? What does it feel like to you to watch things unfold from the perspective where you are now?
You know, it's a tremendous feeling. I mean, you really feel like you have a view from the shoulders of generations. You know, I'm a fifth generation member of the association, and you know, we've been working for this moment, I guess, implicitly since our founding, and really explicitly since 1960, you know, just generations of activists registering people to vote, you know, suing local governments to make sure that blacks could run for various offices. But you know, work that's been done by generations with discipline to get us to a point where finally, 232 years after the founding of this republic, we have a multiracial, multigender race, and it's incredible.
Let's go back to some of the practical issues, because it strikes me that one of the people who certainly knows so much about politics, Donna Brazile, mentioned something about what can go wrong with the vote. In the year 2000, her sister encountered problems. She was asked by authorities to provide multiple forms of ID on her way to vote. And she called up Donna, and Donna, of course, was like, well, that's not the way things are supposed to work.
Right.
But there's voting law, and then there's practice. And hopefully they're usually pretty close together. But what should people do if they're being pressured? You gave out the 800 number, but if they're pressured by authorities, that can be a very delicate situation. So should people directly challenge the authorities if they think that they're being misled or steered wrong?
They should request a provisional ballot. A bylaw, they're required to give you a provisional ballot if you request, even if you don't show up on their list. You know, even if the address on your driver's license is different than what they have on their list. And so they should just request a provisional ballot, fill it out. It will be counted and it will be verified. And that's, you know, that's what people need to know their rights, and they need to stand their ground. The reality is that black people, women, people of color in this country have all fought to get to this moment, and many people, have died, have been beaten up, trying to assert their right to vote in this country. So just standing there with backbone and saying, I know my rights, give me my provisional ballot. If you don't, I'm going to dial 1-866-OUR-VOTE, is the least you can do.
When people talk about voter suppression, there are a lot of different things they can be talking about. Do you believe that there is a risk of voter suppression in the 2008 election, and what form could it take?
Yeah, I believe there's a certainty of it. I started out my career as a journalist covering races in Mississippi, and every year people would try to give black people bad information. We at the local black newspaper would find ourselves working with the NAACP trying to get out good information. They would go through black neighborhoods and pass out flyers saying, don't forget to vote on Wednesday, for instance. I'm sure that tactic, which is one of the tried and true, will be tried again somewhere in this country.
Well, Benjamin Jealous, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Benjamin Jealous is the president of the NAACP. Now we've got more advice on making sure your vote counts with George Washington University law professor Spencer Overton. He's the author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression. Plus, we've got Shannon Reeves, a top-ranking staffer for the Republican National Committee. Hi, gentlemen.
Hi, how are you doing, Farai?
Hey there.
Doing great. We're in the home stretch. So, Shannon, I'm going to start with you. You've been working on the ground for the RNC for the last few months. So do you get a sense that people understand their voting rights?
I get a sense that people understand, but I think we also want to always emphasize people's responsibility, that you have a responsibility to be informed and to go out and to cast a ballot. Just in the previous segment, I spent a 20-year career with the NAACP, and noting that, Medgar Evers and Dr. King gave their lives for us to have this right to vote, among others, that it's important for everyone to be steadfast and to not be denied or deterred in going to the polls and to voting on Election Day. So there are a lot of organizations that are at polling places. I'm in Nevada today, and there were, during the early voting last week, there are a lot of organizations present around the polling areas when you have problems. And we encourage people to, if you have problems, even if it's reading your ballot when you're in the ballot box, ask for help from those who are working with the local county to who are working the polls with your local county.
Spencer, there's been a lot of talk about what constitutes fraud, particularly centering around ACORN and voter registrations, and what constitutes voter suppression. So how do you tell the difference between voter suppression and just disorganization if people haven't gotten it together on a local level to run a polling place?
Well, what's most important to voters is that they should go vote. You know, elections are running smoothly. In terms of a distinction between voter fraud and voter suppression in terms of what's out there, the data suggests that claims about voter fraud are exaggerated and irresponsible, frankly. But that is an aside. What's most important is that voters take basic steps, as Shannon has talked about, in terms of a responsibility, taking ID and some supporting documentation and taking some other steps and going in and casting their vote. Most voters are not going to have any trouble. Things are much better than they were in 2000.
All right. Early voters in some precincts have waited up to 6 hours to cast a ballot. One of them texted me from line because I guess she had a lot of time. So we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we can expect some lines. Let's talk about a very specific practical issue, which is getting time off from work. Shannon, how should people ask for time off, and what happens if you go to vote and then you kind of get stuck because you don't want to leave the line, but at the same time, you're not really getting anywhere as fast as you thought you would?
Well, you know, it's amazing to me, all this crying about, you know, how much time it takes, how long you have to wait in line. And maybe I'm just a little too practical. People get off of work to go to ball games, to go to the Essence Festival, to go to anything they want to go to. They find a way. You know, people even lie and call in sick on these jobs. So let's keep it real. This is an opportunity that somebody died for you to have the right and the opportunity to vote. Get out. If you have to stand in line all day, you stand in line for concert tickets, you stand in line to go wherever you want to go,
this is one day in history on tomorrow to go and cast your ballot for the candidate that you believe in the most. And that's what it's all about at the end of the day. So employers, they understand tomorrow's election day. In many places, they give you time off. This is an extraordinary situation with the amount of turnout that we're seeing from across the country, and this is, you know, democracy at its greatest. So I'm not minimizing the fact that there are problems in places with not enough machines or not enough, you know, staff, but work through it and keep it in perspective. Most of the time, when people want to get off these jobs, when they have something else to do, they find a way to do the thing that they enjoy the most for entertainment.
All right. Well, Spencer, how about this? I mean, you know, there are some jobs that, let's be real, it's a little bit easier to get time off than others. I mean, if you're an emergency room ICU nurse, probably not so easy to just say, hey, I'm just going to be off for a little bit. Other jobs, maybe a little easier. But here's a political spin that's just been put on this. MSNBC host Rachel Maddow argued that long voting lines were the modern-day equivalent of the poll tax. And she argued that if you have to take leave and pay for that leave in order to stand in long lines, you are paying for the right to vote. Some people view that as a long stretch of an argument, but what do you think? Do you buy that?
Well, Farai, I will note that Starbucks, McDonald's, they'd go out of business if they made you stand in line 3 or 4 hours to buy a quarter pounder or get a cup of coffee. Certainly the right to vote is more important than those two things. That said, I do agree with Shannon in terms of this notion that if there are problems, one needs to just stay there, whatever it is. I mean, we can debate about what the fixes are in the future. Right now, it's time for America to cast its ballots here in terms of determining who the next president will be and who will fill all these other offices. And it's important to stay there and cast your ballot. If you're in line by the time the polls close, you can stay there and stay in line until you have a chance to cast your ballot.
Quick question. There have been a lot of questions about whether or not you can wear insignia to the polls, you know, your favorite pin, your favorite T-shirt. Shannon and then Spencer, thumbs up on insignia. Can you wear it?
Don't even chance it. Just look, you don't wear that stuff to work every day. You know, just go in. You know, you don't have to. It's not the time to campaign. It's a time to do your civic duty. Now it's personal. Tomorrow it's personal. You can walk precincts. That's over with now. Tomorrow it's time to go into the ballot box, go into the booth, and cast your ballot, and it's personal. You don't have to shine. Look, you want to go to a party afterwards and watch the polls come in, do that. Don't even chance it. Not a button, not a T-shirt, not a cap or anything. Go into the polls with the take ID, even if you think you don't need ID. Be prepared and take this seriously and go in. And I think there are going to be some problems. And keep in mind, both sides are going to – there are lawyers on both sides ready to challenge any and every little thing. Go in, be thoughtful about it, and handle your business. Tomorrow is a big, big day for the country, a big, big day, you know, for all of us. And I just think regardless of who your candidate is, take your responsibility to go. And you don't need the T-shirts and the buttons and the caps. It's not about campaigning. It's about doing what you have to do.
Spencer, we just heard from Ben Jealous, the head of the NAACP. And one of the things that comes up there is the hotline, the voting hotline that they have, and the idea that not just through the NAACP, but through many different sources, there are lawyers on call if you think you're having a problem at the polls that you shouldn't have. Do you expect there to be any legal challenges tomorrow that could slow things down at the very least, or even bring them to a halt in terms of the counting of the ballots and the declaring of the next president?
There may be some challenges, but again, don't stay home because you think that your ballot won't count because there are going to be challenges or problems. Political operatives are not going to steal this election. Voting rights lawyers are defending the right to vote, and the courts have been rejecting barriers to voting. We've seen political operatives bring dozens of lawsuits trying to erect voting barriers in a number of states, and they keep losing. And so it is not going to be a problem. It's incredibly important to cast your ballot. Lawyers and courts are going to protect the right to vote.
Shannon, we've spoken with a variety of black Republicans and black conservatives. We spoke with Michael Steele about what he saw as a very difficult road for black Republicans in terms of gaining traction overall. You are someone who is black, who is conservative, who has been in the past but not currently affiliated with the NAACP. What is the role of the Republican Party in making sure that African Americans have a secure vote tomorrow?
Well, I don't know. We don't have a role in that. The civil rights organizations are going to handle their business when it comes to, like, you had, you know, Ben Jealous on who gave people the 866 our vote. That's going to be the role of the civil rights organization. I don't think either political party is going to actually play a role in actually doing that. I think, you know, from the Republican National Committee standpoint and the party, you know, we're going to work to get all the votes out for our candidate. But I just can't emphasize how important it is for, you know, for everybody to exercise their right. I mean, after the election is over, regardless of who is the winner at the presidential of this election or all the elections across the country, the Republican Party, we're going to be in a rebuilding mode because we're going to either have a new president from our party or we're going to have an election and review the results and find out how do we rebuild our organization and prepare for cycles in the future. So I think there's opportunity. There's plenty of room at the table for African Americans in my party to play a role in the future development of the Republican Party, which I think is very, very needed.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there, but I'm sure we'll be checking in with both of you over the exciting coming days. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks so much, Farai.
We've been speaking with Shannon Reeves, a top-ranking staffer for the Republican National Committee. Also, Spencer Overton, a professor of law at George Washington University. He's also the author of Stealing Democracy, The New Politics of Voter Suppression, and he joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. Before we go, we hope you're going to join us tomorrow evening as we continue our election coverage online. Just visit our blog at nprnewsandviews.org. We'll be live blogging as well as video blogging throughout the evening as the election results come in.